Welcome to our second session on Introduction to Stocks. And in this session, we'll be discussing transactions and transaction costs. We'll take a look at the various indices that we've been talking about so far all along and actually define them. But first, let's take a quick look at the old bull market versus bear market. Slide number 34. Bull markets are favorable markets normally associated with rising prices, investor optimism, economic recovery, and government stimulus. Everybody's partying, the market's going up, whereas bear markets are unfavorable markets normally associated with falling prices, investor pessimism, economic slowdown, and government restraint. And where did the terms come from? Well, it depends on who you talk to, but bull markets are associated with bulls because supposedly bulls charge ahead. They throw their opponents up into the air with their horns, and bears are more reclusive, and when they do attack, they knock their opponents down with their paws. But supposedly there's another reason why they're called bear markets, and it has to do with trappers and bear hunters that would sell the bear skins and don't sell the bear skin before the bear is caught. I can't figure out how it relates to that, but if you are the kind of person who really is excited about word etymology, I think I said that right, feel free to go look it up. Slide number 35, the types of transactions. Now, I want you to remember these four, but the problem is it's a little difficult to know the difference between the last two, the third and the fourth one. So if you just lump those two together, that would be fine with me. The first one is the market order. This by far is the most popular with buy and hold investors who are just simply looking to buy shares or sell shares at the market. So whatever the best price is, Mr. Broker, Ms. Broker, either a human or now more and more a computer, get me the best price for when I buy it or when I sell it. But you don't have to accept the market. You can set what is called a limit order. A limit order says, yes, sure, I'll buy these shares, but they have to fall to a certain price. They might be selling at 25. I'll be interested in buying 70 shares or whatever, but if the price falls to 22, then I'll buy. And so you put in a limit order to buy at 22. Now, if the price never goes to 22, you're not going to buy. But if the price falls to 22, the computer system will automatically click in and you will buy those shares. And the same thing is true with selling. If you said the current market price is 25, but I'm not willing to accept that price, I'll set a limit order at 29. So if it ever hits 29, that's the price I'm going to sell at. The stop loss and the stop limit orders are basically hybrids of what we just discussed. The stop loss order, sometimes just called a stop loss order, says I will buy or sell at the current price once a trigger point, once a certain amount is reached, then it becomes a market order. So the limit order says, look, I am going to buy at 22, and that is all I will pay. Whereas the stop loss order or the stop order, if the price hits 22, I will buy. But it may go back up before my order is executed, so I might buy it at a bit of a higher price. You understand? And so it becomes essentially a market order. Now, the stop, why is it called a stop loss order? Because often traders and speculators will say, I want to stop this, I want to stop loss. I want to sell if the price goes below a certain amount so that I don't lose too much. So the price might be 25, and I'm going to set a stop loss at 20. So if the price ever hits 20, I want to bail. I want to get out. Even if I'm not standing and sitting in front of my computer terminal watching it, I want out. And that's why they're called stop loss orders sometimes, also just called stop orders. The problem with this is that if it reaches that $20 trigger point, then it automatically becomes a market order. So you might not sell at 20. You might sell at 16. If the price is plummeting, you might be stopped out, as they say, but at a price that is much lower than what you had set the stop for. And that's why there are stop limit orders. Once the trigger price is reached, then it becomes a limit order. So I will set a stop loss, for example, at $20. But I will not sell at anything less than $20. So if it hits 20, I want to stop my loss, but I set a stop limit order. And if it hits 20, I sell at 20. If it goes below 20, don't sell. You understand the subtle difference? That's why I'm not too worried about you understanding the difference between the stop loss or stop order and the stop limit order. Just know that once it hits a trigger point, that's when the transaction will occur. And let's read at the bottom. Although you can use limit orders to buy or sell at the price you want, and stop loss and stop limit orders to lock in profits or protect against losses, remember that they trigger automatically. It's all computerized now. If for some reason you change your mind, it's often too late to get to the terminal and cancel the transaction. And now the next slide is a graphic from the fourth edition. It's the same graphic as in the fifth and the sixth, but I like this one a little better. And it tries to show you the difference, differences between the four, and basically what we've said. The market order is buy at the best price, sell at the best price. The limit order is buy at the best price, but not more than the preset limit. And the sell order is sell at the best price, but not less. And now the differences between the stop order and the stop limit, that's where it gets a little subtle. The stop order, when you're buying, converts to a market order to buy when the stock price crosses the stop price from below. So you might not get the price you set the trigger at. It might be higher. And the same thing is true on the way down. When you're selling, it converts to a market order to sell when the stock price crosses the stop price from above. And that's why it's called a stop loss, because, hey, get me out of here, get me out of here. And then the stop limit, they don't convert to a market order, they convert to a limit order. Now, I will tell you my biases right up front. I normally use and recommend market orders. If you want to buy the stock, buy it. If you want to sell it, sell it. But short-term traders and speculators tell me they prefer limit orders or stop orders on all of their trades. So it's just a different mindset. Okay? So make sure you have scribbled down those four and can reasonably differentiate between the market order, limit order, and then the two different types of stop orders. Now, on slide 37, we have a brief little discussion of buying on margin and selling short. The book in chapter 2 spends much time discussing margin accounts, selling short, buying on margin. We will discuss these in detail late in the semester. My advice to you, dear student, is never sell short. It's just too risky. And using a margin account can be useful once you have built a substantial portfolio, because it allows you to borrow from your portfolio without selling your stocks, generating commissions, and generating taxable transactions. But all I want you to know for Chapter 5 are the two bullet items on this slide. Buying on margin allows you to borrow money from your broker to enhance your return. You're borrowing money to buy an investment, right? Which is what you do when you do real estate, right? You borrow. Most people don't pay cash for their real estate. They put a down payment and they borrow the rest. And that you can do that with stocks, but it's not 20% as it is with real estate. It's 50%. And then selling short is borrowing stock and selling it in the hopes that the price will go down. Wait a minute. You borrow something and sell it? You sell something you do not own? That doesn't sound legal. Well, it's perfectly legal, providing you've filled out all the correct forms. You must buy it back in some time in the future. So all you have to remember is what we just described. Buying on margin is borrowing money to buy shares of stock to enhance your return. And selling short is borrowing stock and selling it in the hopes that the price will go down and then you buy it back later. So instead of buying and then selling, you sell and then buy. You understand? It doesn't matter to the brokerage firm in what order you do it. It's trickier than that, and we will come back to it in detail at the very end of the semester. But for now, that is all you need to know, is that you can borrow money to enhance your return, and you can make transactions that will make you money if a stock price goes down. Short selling short. Now, slide 38, transaction costs. Well, transaction costs have changed as internet technology and technology in general has changed. Traditionally, transaction costs were in the 1 to 5% range, sometimes higher, and the largest percentage of the cost was normally the brokerage's commission. But deep discount internet brokers have driven the commissions down to as low as $5 a trade. And there's one brokerage firm offering free trades. Now, they don't do it anymore. I'm pretty sure Zecco, it's called Zecco.com. I'm pretty sure they don't do it anymore. But for a while there, they were offering free trades. What? How could they make it? It doesn't make any sense. But have transaction costs really gone down? Yes, they have. The transaction costs have gone down. But more and more the cost is hidden from the investor, especially with the internet garbage brokers. Now, folks, those aren't my words. I remember talking to somebody and just saying, oh, well, I'm not going to deal with any of these internet garbage brokers. And I thought, well, it's not a very nice thing to say. And I said, why'd you say that? And then he went on to explain something, and I did not understand. And, you know, this because it wasn't in the Series 7. I was interested. I'd already become a broker, and I didn't quite understand how that worked. I was pretty upset when I found out, as we'll see over the next couple of slides, because the brokerage firm I worked for didn't do this stuff, and I just thought, that's not very nice, but that's how. But we charge a whole lot more per trade, so it's very different. Slide 39. Here's an example. A deep discount internet broker, which shall remain nameless, Scottrade, but they're not the only ones, folks. These are not all of the E-Trashes, E-Trades, and the TD Ameritrash, TD Ameritrade, they all do it. So deep discount internet broker offers trades for $7. In the fine print of the client broker agreement is included a provision for allowing the broker to solely utilize exclusive stock dealers and market makers. Now, remember that the quoted price is simply the best price available. But at any one time, there are dozens of prices quoted as dealers and market makers compete for buy and sell orders. I want you to take a look at the presentation about the Casas de Cambio, where you see all different prices for buying and selling pesos. Well, that's what's going on in the stock market world. You see the bid and the ask price when you go look it up on the internet or at your broker, but that's just the best price. The chosen dealer doesn't necessarily have the best price. Instead of paying $20, the investor might pay $20.05 or 3 cents. So the investor sees the $7 commission on their confirmation, but the investor does not see the extra $5 they paid on a $100 share purchase because of the 5 cent dealer markup. Do you understand? Right, exactly. So it really cost you $12, but you don't see that. Right. Slide number 40. The following disclaimer is included in each trade confirmation email from Scottrade. Scottrade Incorporated receives remuneration, that means money, for directing orders to particular broker dealers or market centers for execution. Such remuneration money is considered compensation to the firm, and the source and amount of any compensation received by the firm in connection with your transaction will be disclosed upon request. Yeah, why do they make it all uppercase? Well, they know. They're not stupid. They know that uppercase looks more impressive. It looks like it's important, but people don't read it because it's harder to read than upper and lowercase. But in Scott Trade's defense, at least they prominently disclose this relationship in every confirmation email that you receive from them. Other brokers hide it in the customer's agreement fine print, and the customers are never aware of this relationship. And I was not aware of this at first. Well, I didn't deal with them. I was dealing with our brokerage firm. But I was really surprised when I learned this. And, of course, we don't charge. We didn't, and this is the one I was brokerage firm I was with at the time, we didn't charge $7 a trade. If you look on Yahoo, and there's a little presentation already up there, you're seeing the price as it was 15 minutes ago, if the market's open. You're not seeing the current price. You have to pay extra for that. Or just go to your brokerage firm, and you can watch, and they'll have some pretty slick connections to the markets. And we can turn on the trades we can actually watch the trades on any individual stock as they go by, and they go by quickly, folks. They go by very fast. So I was watching once to see, and you see different prices. You know, they're pennies apart now. It used to be they were higher, there were bigger gaps, bigger spreads, but now they're pennies apart. And I stood there once as we entered an order for an odd number of, like 178 shares or something. And I watched as they came streaming by, and sure enough, within, you know, it happens very quickly. As soon as we put the order in, I watched it go streaming by, and our price was the best. I mean, that was the current price. But, you know, at the time, I was working on a brokerage firm where it was $45 a trade. So you see, it's a big difference, isn't it? But you dealt directly with the broker. You didn't. These were people. This was a brokerage firm, a little bit old school, and you had a personal broker, and you dealt directly with that broker. So there, that's the difference. You understand? So in Scottrade's defense, they at least disclose this relationship. Slide 41. The Securities and Exchange Commission says that your broker has a duty to seek the best execution that is reasonably available for its customers' orders. Okay, there's the wiggle room. What is reasonable? But it is not a guarantee. The Securities and Exchange Commission requires broker-dealers to notify their customers if their orders are not routed for best execution. Typically, this disclosure is on the trade confirmation slip you receive after placing your order. So you see that that's what Scottrade is doing. They're saying, you know, your orders were not routed for the best execution. And determining whether or not a customer got best execution can be very difficult. So here's an article from a law professor's website where the Securities and Exchange Commission is trying to enforce the rules. And they're saying to Scottrade, you know, Scottrade, you didn't give your customers the best price. And Scottrade said, oh, we sure did. We did a reasonable accommodations and got our customers the best price. And so it's not easy. It's just not easy. Slide 42. The Securities and Exchange Commission I haven't heard anything lately, but they were looking into making the costs more transparent, possibly showing the customer the difference between the dealer's price and the best price available at the time of the transaction. Maybe even, gasp, showing the total cost of the transaction from the markup and the markdown. Needless to say, the deep discount brokers cried that it would drive up the cost of commissions and ultimately hurt the consumer, and the proposal has seemed to have died. So it is up to you, dear investor, to check if you are getting the best execution. But how can you, a lone investor, determine if you're getting the best price if even the Securities Exchange Commission has trouble watching over your brokerage companies? And the answer, I guess the best answer that we, you know, small investors can do is you have to trust who you're dealing with. And if you don't necessarily trust them, then you have to realize that you're paying a little bit more. But again, it's not that much more money. It's not, I mean, we're not talking about, they're not, if you were dealing in thousands of shares, yes, you better get the best, because then there's definitely serious money being lost. But no, for most of us, it's pennies. It's not a big deal. And we will discuss brokerage firms at the end of the semester in detail, and I'll give you what my thoughts and recommendations are about brokerage firms. All right? Okay. Let's continue. Now, slide 43, round lot and odd lot. This has been basically made obsolete because of technology, but it used to be that brokerage firms and these exchanges only wanted you to buy and sell in 100 round lots, 100 share increments. They were called a round lot. One lot was 100 shares, two lots was 200 shares. And the reason for this was because of the double auction face-to-face system. So a broker whose job it was to buy 100 shares would yell out a price, and they would yell out 22, and they would take their hand and move it toward themselves. Meaning, I'm calling out for $22 as 100 shares. They don't have to say anything other than the price if they are buying 100 shares. If they're selling 100 shares, they would yell out 22, but then they would move their hand away from themselves. I'm putting 100 shares out there at 22. If they said 2 at 22, it meant 200 shares at the price, either buying or selling. So you see how that facilitated trading, made trading a whole lot faster, but it's gone. I mean, that face-to-face double auction system is gone. So they don't care anymore. If they were to sell an odd lot, that meant they had to say 17 shares at 22. So it slowed things down. So they hit you with what is called an odd lot differential. If you sold in less than 100 share increments, you were hit with the odd lot differential. That traditionally, during the time of full face-to-face double auction, the odd lot differential, believe it or not, was 12.5 cents to 25 cents. Again, that's technology taking over and obliterating the old way of doing things. 12.5 cents? Yeah, that's an eighth of a dollar. They would trade in eighths. But now it's typically less than 5 cents, maybe even a penny. Some people recommend against odd lot purchases because of the higher cost. But on 10 shares, it might be a buck. It might be, you know, 50 cents. On 80 shares, it might be $4. Big deal. It's not that big a deal. For us smaller investors, it's not that big a deal. You want to buy 16 shares, you go buy 16 shares. So you pay an extra 20, 30 cents, 50 cents. Big deal. You understand? Okay, good. But you have to know this as, you know, students of investing. You have to understand the difference between a round lot and an odd lot, even though technology has made it obsolete. Slide number 44, reading stock quotes. Well, different sources will contain some or all or more of these statistics. But always remember that when the market is open, the quoted prices are not the only prices available. At any one time, there are many prices available, just as there are many different prices at the Casas de Cambio for buying and selling pesos from many different dealers and market makers. The quoted prices are simply the best prices available. Plus, usually, unless you pay extra or you're sitting at your broker's firm, you are seeing the current prices 15 to 20 minutes into the past. So what are we looking at? The current price, the bid and the ask, the open, the high, low, and the close, the 52-week high and low. How's it done over the last 52 weeks? The dividend yield, the P.E. ratio, the volume, and that change, the year-to-date change. Some of this I'm going to ask you to look up, to research in the assignment for Chapter 5. And I have a little presentation on Yahoo that we'll discuss in a moment here. Slide 45. Many people say, well, do you have your students read the Wall Street Journal? And I say, no. Ooh, who? Why not? I say, because I don't read the Wall Street Journal. I mean, the cool thing about Yahoo, I like to use Yahoo, and I don't own any stock in Yahoo, so don't get wrong. But they have links to many different places around the web. So they have links to the Wall Street Journal. So if I see an article that interests me. But this is from the fourth edition, right? No, the third edition. I think it's the third edition. That is a graphic that shows the quotes from the Wall Street Journal, and they're highlighting Johnson & Johnson, right? And I just wonder, oh my God, you mean you actually wait until the next day to find out how much your stock is worth? Oh, how 20th century. And you'll notice that the Wall Street Journal is the only newspaper that still bothers to put them in. All the other newspapers stop putting them in because they know everybody uses the internet to look it up. So speaking of the infernal net, slide number 46, what are some of the more popular websites? Well, Yahoo is one of the most popular, I've noticed. Bloomberg's is another one that's very popular. People tell me they like that one. The CBS MarketWatch, but I think that was bought. I think MarketWatch was bought by Wall Street Journal now, wasn't it? I got to go back and look. Any others you want to check out? Well, this isn't the face-to-face class. We would right now go to Yahoo and take a look at it. Go to Bloomberg's. Go to MarketWatch. The biggest reasons I use Yahoo are because I believe it is the easiest one to use, and it's also easiest on the eyes. They came out with a newer version about a year and a half ago, and the newer version, in my humble opinion, is harder on your eyes. Some of the other sites have started to add more white space, which I believe is easier on the eyes. I literally recoil from the sites that fill up every square centimeter on the screen with information. So, yeah, everybody's different. Everybody's different. Some people like all that busyness going on. I don't, but that's me. And again, I don't own any stock. If you don't use Yahoo, I don't lose any money or anything like that. Note to online students, please go see the accompanying presentation on how to use Yahoo Finance to do your research. But again, use whichever one you want. You know the one that's probably not very good, and they even admit it, is Google's. And Google really hasn't done much to make their finance page much better. So I wonder why. I don't understand why. But Yahoo's is actually pretty good, and so is Bloomberg and CNBC and all those. They're all competing, so check them out. Slide 47. Okay, now let's spend a little bit of time and finally define these indices, these averages, these benchmarks, these things that we've been discussing since the beginning of the semester. Because it's time. It's finally time. How can we say that stocks have returned approximately 10%, it's actually closer to about 11, over the past 70 years? Huh? Well, how can we say that? Because any one stock, it's very unlikely that that stock will have done that. In fact, many of them haven't been around that, and many of the stocks that were around are gone. The industry uses market averages and indexes to measure the general behavior of securities prices. Now, these things are also called benchmarks. And if you don't understand the word benchmark, go look it up, because think of it as a measurement. What do we measure? How do we measure something? And when you were doing the Chapter 4 assignments, that was one of the things I asked you. Well, what is the benchmark? Or sometimes they use more than one, depending on the mutual fund. What are they comparing themselves against? And if it were a domestic large cap growth and income fund, they would use the Standard & Poor's 500. If it were a global growth fund, they would use the MSCI World Fund, or the newer one that we'll see. And some people have a hard time finding that because they don't really understand what it means. But this is what it means. How do we measure how well we're doing? How do we measure how the market is doing? So these benchmarks are used to measure the general behavior of securities prices by reflecting either the average price behavior, the market average, or the relational price behavior, a market index of representative groups of securities at a given point in time. And you can't help but hear about these things every day, but a lot of people don't know what it means. The Dow went up. The Nasdaq went down. What does that mean? What does it mean? Well, it must be good, right? The Dow went up. And most people, even when they do know what they are, don't understand that there's a difference between a market average and a market index, because the differences are very subtle, and the book goes into quite a bit of detail about them, but I don't care that you know the difference that much. Just know that they are market averages and indexes, and they are meant to measure the general behavior of the stock market, or, you know, the bond market, if they're bond indexes, which we'll look at later on. Slide 48 describes the share price calculation, a market average, which looks solely at the price of the stock without regard to the market value. And the most popular and most well-known is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The other type is the market-weighted calculation, which is a market index. It looks at the stock price times multiplied by the number of shares outstanding. So it takes into account the actual market value of the stock in the index. And we'll take a look at what is called capitalization, the market value, later on in another presentation. The larger the market share, the more influence the security will have in the index. So the biggest example, well, the other one is the NASDAQ composite, but the Standard & Poor's 500, which we have been discussing quite a bit. The Standard & Poor's 500, traditionally the 500 largest companies in the United States. But the problem with that is that the first 50 are huge compared to the last 50. So when you start making these indices have 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 stocks, the value of the company has to be taken into account. You have to say, wait a minute, it doesn't make sense to compare the number one company in size with the number 500 company in size without making some kind of allowance for the fact that the number one company is, you know, 400 times larger or 30 times larger than the number 500 company. And market-weighted calculations were generally regarded as a better measure until they weren't. Until the bubble of the late 1990s when there was a skewing of certain companies. Sound familiar? We discussed this back in Chapter 4, didn't we? Yes, we did a little bit. The Dow Jones Industrial Average. The Dow. The DJIA, sometimes you'll see it written as. This is the oldest and the most well-known, but it's actually not the best, in my humble opinion. And who is Dow Jones, by the way? That's the company that publishes the Wall Street Journal. And a few years back, they were purchased by the Fox News company, Rupert Murdoch's company called News Corp. So it was generally published that he paid about $2 billion more. They figured the Dow Jones company was worth about $3 billion, and he paid $5 billion. He didn't care. He wanted Dow Jones. The stock market average, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, is made up of 30 high-quality stocks selected for total market value and broad public ownership and believed to reflect overall market activity. And they use the average, that's why it's called an average, the share price calculation. As we said, it's the most famous of the Dow, of the stock market measures. And even though it's still called the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the content, the companies, change from time to time as companies and industries evolve. And as such, it now has more non-industrial stocks than industrial stocks. And that's why a lot of people just call it the Dow Average, because they should have taken the word industrial out a long time ago. And who are they? Well, here they are. Slide number 50. These are, as of this writing, the 30 stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Now, the companies change as certain companies do well and certain companies don't do well. And just last year, they got rid of Kraft, and which is a food company, right? Because Kraft split in two, and then they put in United Healthcare, which healthcare industrial. I mean, figure that one out. But the real problem with the Dow, in my humble opinion, is that it's only 30 stocks, and Dow Jones has been in the last 20, 30 years. They've been moving things in and out quite a bit. Quite a bit faster than they did in the past, and they've been putting in companies just as they got huge, for example, Microsoft and Intel in 1999, right before the tech bubble burst, and Microsoft has done nothing since then. And I think they took out Union Carbide, which was an industrial, was a chemical company, and then they put in who'd they put in? AIG, which was an insurance company, which is one of the companies that we taxpayers owned after the, we don't own it anymore, we sold it off, but we taxpayers owned it after it literally imploded after the financial turmoil of 2008, and they didn't take out GM until GM was practically in bankruptcy. So the Dow, even though people will say, oh, we'll see a slide, but the Dow is back where it was 10, 12 years ago. Well, no, it isn't, because it's a very different index. They're always taking companies out, putting companies in, and so... Whatever, it's a perfect index or it's not a perfect index, this is what we hear every day in the news. And so you're looking at these 30 companies, and most all of them, you know who they are: Disney, Coca-Cola, AT&T, Alcoa makes aluminum, DuPont, Procter & Gamble, what do they make? Tide, Pampers, Head & Shoulders, Gillette Razors, 3M, what are the three? Minnesota Mining and Materials, Scotch Tape, Post-it Notes. And you're saying, well, that's interesting, right? Well, what happened? If the Dow went up 100 points in one day, it means the average of all these companies' prices went up 100. That's what it means. That's what it means. And not $100, they call them points, and they're It started out as dollars back in 1896, I think, but now they're, because of splits and companies merging and the like, there's some kind of calculation that they describe in the book, but it's not important because it's done for you. There's one company that was in the original Dow Jones Industrial Average back in 1896. Can you guess which one it was? General Electric, right. Slide number 51. This slide shows you that there are times when the market, as measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average, does well, and there are times when it doesn't do much anything. Between 1906 and 1924, it went from 100 to 100. I didn't mean it stay 100. It went up and down and up and down. But then, between 1924 and 1929, it rose three times, only to then plummet after the roaring 20s and the great bubble of the late 20s, 1929, ushering in the Great Depression. And didn't make it back up to 300 until 1954, 25 years. And then between 1954 and 1966, it went up three times, only then to go up and down for a total of 16 years, right? Breaking 1,000 in 66, breaking it again in 72, right? And then not breaking it again until 1982. And then look at what happened between 1982 and 2000, right? Yeah, from 1,000 to 11,000, and then from 2000 to 2011, going up and down and up and down, and finally making it back to 11,000 in 2011. And where is it now? Around 14,000? Does that mean it's going to go back to 11,000? I don't know, but a lot of people are saying it's going to crash again. We'll see. Actually, I like it when people say it's going to crash. It makes me feel better, because usually they're wrong. When everyone says it's going to skyrocket, they're usually wrong. When everyone says it's going to crash, they're usually wrong. But when you hear some people say it's going to go up and some people say it's going down, that probably means it's just going to bounce along and maybe do a little bit up, maybe it'll do a bit down. So, the question is, well, how to make money in stocks during times when the markets and capital gains are flat? The answer depends on whether you or not you are an investor or whether or not you are a speculator, a trader. The speculator or trader is going to try to time when things go up and when things go down and make money doing those kind of trades. It's going up a little bit now. I'm waiting for it to go down. I'll sell, and then I'll wait for it to bottom out, and then I'll buy and go back up again. Good luck with that. What does the investor do? The investor keeps a long-term time horizon, collects their dividends, and, as Mr. Bogle says, enjoys the fruits of business enterprises that everybody has enjoyed since the beginning of time. Patience. Slide 52. There are other Dow Jones averages. The transportation average. These are 20 railroads, airlines, freight companies. Many investors and economists look at this one because as economic activity increases, one of the leading indicators, they call it a leading indicator, should be, but not always, the transportation sector of the economy. Because before stuff can be made and before it can be sold, it's got to get to where it needs to be made. And then it's got to get to be where it needs to be sold. So they'll look at that. They'll look at the railroads and the FedExes and the UPSs of the world and the airlines and the freight companies. The utilities average measures 15 public utilities. Well, that's pretty steady, right? But utilities don't do much. And if you put the industrial and the transportation and the utilities together, you get the Dow Jones 65 stocks composite average. You very rarely hear about this. Now, the next two we discussed a little bit in Chapter 4. Why? Because these are used more and more in 401k plans and index funds that are inside 401k plans. It's now called the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index and the Dow Jones U.S. Completion Total Stock Market Index. What did these names come from? Who thought these things up? Well, the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index used to be called the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000 Total Market Index, and before that it was called the Wilshire 5000. Wilshire is a company based in L.A., and they came up with an idea of saying, look, let's have a measurement of all the stock market, the big companies, the small companies, and the medium-sized companies. And they called it the Wilshire 5000. And then Dow Jones sort of got in a deal with them and then kicked them to the side. And the Wilshire 4500, which is now called the Dow Jones U.S. Completion Total Stock Market Index, sometimes called the Extended Stock Market Index, was the Wilshire 5000, or is the Wilshire 5000, minus the 500 stocks in the S&P 500. What are you talking about? You see, the Wilshire 5000, I have a hard time calling it Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index. I call it the Wilshire 5000 still, is a measurement of the big companies, the large cap companies. That's the 500, S&P 500, right? The 500 largest companies in the United States. Plus the medium-sized companies, plus the small companies. And so if you want to get a measure of how things are doing, if you don't look at the Papa Bears, the big companies, you take the 5,000 in the 5,000 stocks in the Wilshire 5,000, and you subtract out the top 500. And why am I telling you this? Well, because you should have already taken to research the Thrift Savings Plan. And that's the S fund. That's the S fund. The S fund is the index, which is now called the Dow Jones U.S. Completion Total Stock Market Index, which used to be called the Wilshire 4500. You see, how are the medium-sized and the small-sized companies doing? And it's become popular because it's in more and more 401k plans. Now this last one, I mean there are dozens of these things, but this last one is one of the most famous or infamous, and that's the Dow Jones Internet Index. And this came out at the height of the bubble in the late 1990s, the height of the Internet bubble, because now we were going to have an index that just tracked Internet stocks, and it proceeded to fall 96% or 97%. Yeah. Okay, slide number 53. Here, finally, we finally made it to a slide that defines the Standard & Poor's 500 Composite Index, even though we've been discussing it since the beginning of the semester, and we spent quite a bit of time with it in mutual funds. Well, who are Standard & Poor's, by the way? Standard & Poor's is a research company that is owned by McGraw-Hill. McGraw-Hill is a very big media company. They also happen to be the company that published your textbook. They publish quite a few textbooks. They make a lot of money off of textbooks. They also own radio stations and television stations. And they also own Standard & Poor's. And Standard & Poor's has, for many decades now, this list of the 500 largest companies based in the United States. The 500 stocks chosen for market size, liquidity, and industry group representation. It is a market value weighted index. And we already discussed some of that, right? We said it makes sense to give the bigger companies more say because they're just much bigger than the smaller companies, the 499th and 500th company. As we said, it's traditionally the largest 500 companies, but they now can contain some foreign stocks. For what happened? Well, BP, British Petroleum, is based in the UK, although it's a global company. They bought Amoco, which used to be Standard Oil of Ohio, right? Is that right? I think that's right. And they bought ARCO, Atlantic Richfield, AMPM Markets. So S&P kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, what do we do? You know, these are two of the big companies in the United States. They're in the S&P 500. So they said, all right, let's let BP in. And the same thing happens when Mercedes-Benz bought Chrysler back in 96 or 97. They said, okay, put Daimler in the S&P 500. It's a very popular index, although it's lost some of its original focus. It's used by many, many index funds, as we saw, Vanguard, and now Fidelity, and now everybody else. And because the Standard & Poor's 500 is market-weighted, it was affected by the bubble of the 1990s in a bizarre manner. The market values of a small percentage of technology companies were inflated to extremes, and this skewed the index even more toward those companies, right? Because as a company gets larger, it has more and more influence over the index. And this is what we were looking at in Chapter 4 when we looked at that one slide, and I said, you might not understand this, PE in Japan and the technology companies, but we'll come back to it later on. In 1998, 10% of the gain in the Standard & Poor's 500 was due to just one stock, Microsoft. And you're thinking, wait a minute, this is 500 stocks, and one company is responsible for the 10% gain? Yeah. And this happened just recently with Apple. Apple went from, I forget how many, couple hundred billion to $600 billion of capitalization. Yeah. And the bigger they get, you see what's happening? The bigger they get, the index funds now have to buy more of it. So it's a feedback loop. Because they're market weighted, because the company gets bigger, it has more, it constitutes more of the index. The mutual fund managers have to. They have no choice. They can't say, you know, the price is getting too high, I'm going to sell some of this. They're not allowed to. It gets bigger, they have to put more into it. It gets smaller, they have to sell it. So you see why we say that no investment strategy is perfect, nothing is perfect. Well, we know that for sure, right? We're humans. Okay, and then Standard & Poor's has a whole bunch of others. The Industrial 400, the Mid-Cap 400, Medium-Sized Companies, the Small-Cap 600. Put the 500 together with the Mid-Cap 400 and the Small-Cap, because remember the Index 500 is the large companies, and you get the Standard & Poor's 1500, which is, supposed to be like the Wilshire 5000. Show me how the big companies, the small companies, and the medium-sized companies are doing. And there are dozens of other indices from Standard & Poor's, global, international, sector. Go to their website and you'll see how many there are. Now, the NASDAQ, the Amex, the NYSE have all their own composite indexes. But the one that's most important is the NASDAQ, because this gets quite a bit of press. The NASDAQ, of course, is the place where many of the technology companies live. So when you hear people discuss the NASDAQ, they are asking, how did the NASDAQ do? They're actually asking, how did technology do? Even though some of the companies are not technology, but it's tech heavy, sometimes you'll hear people say. And because of that, it exploded in the late 1990s. In 1995, it was 800. In 5 years later, in 2000, it had risen to 5,000. At the height of the bubble, March 2000, it then proceeded to burst and lose 80% of its value, October 2002. And then when the market started coming back in 2003, it's done fairly well over the last several years. And people say, well, when's the NASDAQ going to get back to 5,000? Well, someday it will. But when it does, it won't be the same index, because many of the companies that drove it to 5,000 are gone. Remember AOL? Yeah. Anyway, that's the one I want you to remember, the NASDAQ, because that's what you'll hear. You'll hear often them on the media, you'll hear the people in the media talk about the Dow and the NASDAQ. Sometimes they'll talk about the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ, and sometimes they'll just put the S&P in the NASDAQ. As we said, we need to familiarize ourselves on slide 56 with the total market indices and the extended, or sometimes called the completion stock market indices. And the most popular seem to be the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index and the Dow Jones U.S. Completion Total Stock Market Index, which used to be called the Wilshire 5000 and the Wilshire 4500. But now Standard & Poor's has its own one, and MSCI has its own, so yikes. Yikes, everybody's competing to get their name on these things. I don't know if they get actually any money because they do this. I don't know if Vanguard has to pay Standard & Poor's for being able to have the 500 index. I don't know. I guess I should research that, but I don't know because I'm not that interested. But you need to understand these. You need to understand the ones. Actually, next slide, I'll discuss it in a minute here. Okay, here we are. Slide number 57. Three more that I want you to remember. The Russell 2000, which was meant to measure small company performance in the United States. So how did they figure this one out? They took the top 3,000 companies, that's the Russell 3000, and then they lopped off the top 1,000 companies. So you see, the Russell 2000 is the top 3,000 without the top 1,000. So get rid of all the big companies and get rid of some of the medium-sized companies, and now we will see how small companies are doing. That's the Russell 2000. And then the last two, which are being replaced by other indices, which are hard to say, are the MSCI indices. Now, you don't have to remember that MSCI stands for Morgan Stanley Capital International. You don't have to remember that, but you have to be able to recognize it, MSCI. And for several decades, their two very important indices were the MSCI World Index and the MSCI EAFE. That's how it's pronounced, although I never heard anybody say otherwise, but maybe other people pronounce it differently. But the MSCI World Index was, and still is, the entire world. Well, the entire developed world. United States, Canada, Western Europe, and Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore. So what's happened is the developing markets have really done well over the last 20-some-odd years. So now they are replaced. Instead of changing the World Index, which is what I probably would have done if they asked me, but they're not asking me, what they're doing is they're replacing the World Index with the MSCI All Country World Index. Yeah, I want you to remember that one. And the EAFE, which was everybody in the developed world except for the United States, remember, international or foreign. The EAFE was, again, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore. And it excluded the United States. So if we had a foreign mutual fund or an international mutual fund, we would use the EAFE as the benchmark to see how we're doing. And now they are replacing that with the MSCI All Country World X USA. They didn't ask me. I would have told them you could have come up with something better than that, folks. I mean, I'm sure you paid a lot of money. All Country World X USA. Okay, well, now here's what I want you to do. Stock worksheet number one contains the indexes that you should know by name. And there's about eight of them. Let me see if I can remember them all. The Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ. Those are the very important ones that you'll hear about. The Wilshire 5000 and the Wilshire 4500, which are now called the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index and the Dow Jones U.S. Completion Total Stock Market Index. So there's five. And then I want you to know the Russell 2000 and the Morgan Stanley World and the Morgan Stanley Capital International, MSCI, that's all you have to remember. You have to be able to identify it. World Index and the EAFE Index. But you also have to know that they're being replaced by the MSCI All Country World Index and the MSCI All Country World X USA Index. You can just imagine these people are just snickering and thinking, oh, we'll never remember any of these. But those are the ones I want you to do, okay? So do the worksheet. There is a commentary and there's an answer key. So you need to know these. You need to study those. And as we said, there are dozens and dozens, and you don't need to know any of them than those eight. All right, great. Let's continue. In your travels along the financial media, you will invariably, every day, up to the minute, up to the second, see graphs showing you how our markets today are unstable. Look at the Dow. It started at just under 14,000 and then went up to 14,000 and plummeted in the noontime hour to 2 p.m. at 13,985, only to come back to basically where it started when the day was new. What's going on here, folks? Well, you mathematicians will know what's happened. What did they do over here? There's a wonderful book written back in the 1950s, so the numbers are all wrong, but it's called How to Lie with Statistics, and it's a fun book. You really should read it, especially if you have any kind of math inclination, and as I said, I have a math degree, and my concentration then was computer science and statistics back in undergrad a million years ago. But anyway, what did they do? They cut off 0 to 13,985. So here's our today's unstable stock market index mania. Let's go to the next line and take a look at stock market index ennui. Do you know what ennui means? It's beyond boredom. Right. If we were to show from 0 to the top, right. So you aren't going to see this graph on the news. No, you're not. And now what we can do on slide 60 is re-examine the volatility from the previous presentation. Remember, we showed you how the market went up and then down and up and then down in 2012? We only showed you from 11,000 to, I'm sorry, from 10,000 to 11,500 or something like that. If we had showed you from zero, in fact, this one's showing you from 5,000. I have to fix that. It's supposed to show you from zero. I got to fix that. If we had showed you from zero to 11,500, it would be even more boring. And again, will you see this graph on the news? No, you won't. That won't sell advertising. That won't get you to be fearful, very fearful, afraid. Don't buy stocks. They're too volatile. Okay. All right, so are you studying? Are you going back over and listening and watching again and making your notes and reading the book? I hope so, folks. See ya in the next section. There we go. I had to fix that. Sorry about that, folks. Now it goes from 0 to 12,000, and now you can see how boring this would be if you saw it on the news, so you won't see it on the news. Sorry about that. There you go. It's been fixed.